Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Remember the 2008 financial crisis and how none of the big banks fully faced the consequences of the meltdown because they were deemed too big to fail? Maybe you haven't heard the story of the only U.S. bank prosecuted in relation to the crisis. Tonight, SDPB-TV brings you the special 90-minute broadcast premiere of Frontline's Abacus Small Enough to Jail. It's the saga of a Chinese-American family who own and operate Abacus Federal Savings in New York's Chinatown. Joining us now with more is the film's director from Chicago, Illinois. We're reaching him, Steve James. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Let's talk about Thomas Sung, who is sort of the patriarch of this family and the founder of Abacus Bank. Why did he get into banking in the first place? It's such a compelling story.
It is. Well, he was probably 50 or 51, a very successful lawyer, living in Chinatown, when he decided that he needed to serve the community in a different way because he discovered that even he had trouble getting banks to do more than just sort of take his money as a depositor, that if he wanted to borrow money and do anything more, that was a problem. And he imagined that it was even a more severe problem for many of the residents in Chinatown. So back in the mid-'80s, he decided to start and become a banker to do that, to serve the community. And that's what Abacus grew to be over the many years.
How did you come across this story and decide that there was enough there? It's so dramatic. It almost writes itself. But
yeah,
it would have been hard to walk away from this story, I would think.
It would have. I didn't know anything about it until the trial was imminent, and that was because no one was writing about this story in the mainstream media. Now, the Chinese American press in New York City was very much so, but the mainstream media really ignored this story for the most part. A couple of articles here and there. The New York Times, venerable New York Times, did an article on the indictment in 2012 and on the verdict in 2015, and nothing in between. So I heard about it from Mark Mitten, one of the producers of the film. Mark and I go back a number of years, and he was friends with the family, and he came to me right as the trial was about to get underway, and he said, "There's this crazy case going on in New York. I know the family. I think it's important. What do you think?" And so we went and did the story.
You got incredible access to the family themselves, to the conversations that they were having. How did you develop that relationship?
Well, I think it really began with Mark because of his 10-year relationship with the family. There was an immediate sort of trust and bond there that you know, you always welcome if it exists. But I had to then kind of earn my trust with them as well, and so I think that what helped it was the fact that they felt so strongly about the injustice they felt being put on trial, and they felt like it wasn't just something that they were going through, but their community was in a sense going through that, right? that their community was being singled out in a way. And so I think that all contributed to their desire to be a part of this. And then once we got underway and I established a rapport with them, you know, that trust grew as well.
Let's get into the details of the story because many people haven't heard it. And again, you can see the full film tonight at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain on SDPB-TV. Let's start by how banking is different for immigrants from China. It sort of starts... The bank sort of brings people in with a safe deposit box. How is banking different for them?
Yeah, well, that's right. In the bowels of Abacus main branch in Chinatown, there's something like 8,000 security boxes, deposit boxes, and that really speaks volumes. I mean, so it starts at a very basic level, but then for that community, you know, and it's true of immigrant communities throughout our history, but we're talking about Chinese immigrants here, you know, who are trying to gain a foothold in this country. They very much are often part of a kind of cash economy at the lower rungs of American economic life, and they're sort of trying to work their way, you know, up the ladder, as it were. And so when it comes to trying to do that and buy your first home or build a business, you know, one of the things the DA's office chose to ignore and even exploit and try to paint as fraudulent was is that a lot of times, you know, in these communities, people would pull their resources, families would, to help get a down payment on, mm-hmm. on a home or a business. And, of course, the DA's office, when they went to trial over this, they tried to paint these gift letters as fraudulent, as if, you know, these family members were expecting to be paid back with interest and that the borrower was misrepresenting it. And that's just not true. So, you know, one of the things Abacus understands about their community is that there are unique situations that accrue there that they have to take into account if they're going to successfully work with that population and help them get mortgages and buy businesses. And they're clearly doing something right, because Abacus default rate on their loans is something like 1/20th of the national average.
Right.
They didn't do anything related to the 2008 crisis. They did not engage in any of those fraudulent vehicles. And yet, D.A. Cyrus Vance Jr., when he indicted them, made explicit connection to say that this is the kind of fraud that went on in 2008 and that Abacus was engaged in it, which
right.
was patently false.
Because what are they accused? Fannie Mae is in here. So they are accused of, and you hear Fannie Mae and you hear some of the things they're accused of, and it rings familiar with the banking crisis, and that was exploited, as you say. But what exactly
yeah.
are they accused of doing here?
Well, first of all, it started with a loan officer who was quite corrupt, and he was definitely an outlier in terms of Abacus. A guy named Ken Yu, who was taking and demanding bribes from borrowers, and once Vera Sung and Jill Sung, the daughters of Thomas, who were high up in the bank, Jill's president, Vera vice president. Once they discovered what Ken Yu was doing, they fired him immediately.
Right.
And then they initiated their own investigation to see if similar things were going on amongst loan officers. And they discovered enough fraud among at least a couple of them that they fired a couple of other employees. And, you know, this they did on their own. They initiated their own internal investigation. They reported it to the Regulatory Commission. But once Vance got a hold of it, Ken Yu became the star witness. And expectation around that is that they had him dead to rights. He was clearly very guilty, but he offered them up the brass of the bank as a way of making a plea bargain, and they ran with it, and he became the star witness in the trial. And, you know, he would go on the stand and make these claims that then the defense lawyers would turn around and completely destroy in cross-examination.
Ken Yu's testimony becomes almost laughable, or actually laughable to the jury
yeah.
members themselves. Tell me a little bit about just how his lies are really picked apart on the stand.
Well, you know, for instance, early on he says, you know, he says that he didn't demand any bribes.
Right.
You know, and then, and it's interesting because the DA's office, in an effort to entrap the borrower that initiated this case, to entrap Ken Yu, they had the borrower record a conversation with Ken Yu that he didn't know about. Well, in it, he admits to he admits to taking bribes, and also in that very conversation, he strongly implies that the higher ups of the bank didn't know what he was up to.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So the DA's office buried that recording. They recorded it, but they buried it in the trial while the defense lawyers got a hold of it and presented it in the trial. But this was typical of Ken Yu. He would claim that Vera Sung knew and endorsed a fraudulent loan application, and then it would become clear that he had done all of his dirty work after she had made the approval of the loan.
I want to get at this larger idea of how this family felt. The trial became an attack on an entire community. And let's start with sort of the spectacle of the
yeah.
chain gang, or the Chinese people in chains with their heads bent over, holding yeah. on to each other and kind of walking through the hallways. What in the world was behind that?
Well, that was back in 2012 when Vance announced the indictment of Abacus with great fanfare. You know, he brought federal prosecutors from Washington down who had nothing to do with this case, but it was just for show. They stood behind him as if to sort of say, yes, we stand behind this indictment of this bank in the wake of the 2008 crisis. He made a point in his press conference of connecting it to the crisis and talking about how complicit and the bank was in the fraud. And then the biggest spectacle of all is what you talked about. They paraded a number of mostly ex-low-level employees and a few current employees down the hallway for the cameras and the media, chained together as if they were, you know, the kingpins of the Medellin drug cartel or something. You know, I mean, these, you know, lawyers in our film speak to, several lawyers in our film speak to the fact that in 20 years of being lawyers in New York City, and they had never seen anything like that with suspects in crimes like that. And, you know, for the community, this spoke volumes. It spoke being singled out. It harkened back to history of Chinese laborers being chained together. You know, it had quite an impact, and no one could understand why this bank was being singled out in such a way when they had kind of done everything they could to cooperate until they realized that they were going to be put on trial.
Well, let's talk about the meanwhile. Let's talk about the big banks, because Abacus is something like the 2,651st largest bank in the United States.
Yeah. They've slipped a notch. I think they're down to 2,652nd.
So not an obvious target, but meanwhile, put it into context. You've got Morgan Stanley and Citicorp and J.P. Morgan Chase. What are some of the questions about the deals that are offered them, and then compare it with the deals that the government offers Abacus?
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. I mean, those banks, of course, were deemed too big to fail. They were bailed out, you know, after they nearly crashed the world economy. They were then bailed out because what they had done pretty much crashed their business. And you know, the government decided that because of this concept of collateral consequences, which actually was originated by Eric Holder long before he was Attorney General, by the way, that they decided that it was dangerous to the world economy and the U.S. economy to prosecute these banks criminally. So what they did was is that they, you know, they fined them heavily. Of course, after they had bailed them out, they fined them. But the deal was that there would be no felony charges and no one would go to jail or even be put on trial. Well, with Abacus, that wasn't the case. You know, first of all, as I've kind of said, they were the mirror opposite. Nothing about what they did coincided with what the big banks did, you know, in any way, shape, or form. But once D.A. Vance indicted them, the deal that was offered to Abacus was is that you could pay a large fine and plead guilty to a felony conviction. Well, for the family, who felt they were completely innocent to begin with, I mean, the possibility of paying a fine they might have considered just to save them the terrible stress and strain and financial demand of going to trial. But there was no way they were going to plead guilty to a felony when they felt they were innocent. It could have easily brought the bank down and, of course, stained their legacy and brought them tremendous shame.
Let's talk a little bit about these family members and the daughters. We have Jill, and she's kind of a fiery personality. She wants to she just wants to get back to work. Please, just let me get back to work.
Yeah, the daughters, I mean, they're such an amazing family, and I think one of the unexpected sort of pleasures and joys of this film is that people go into it thinking it's going to be a red meat financial story, you know, and it is that, and about injustice, and it is that. But the heart of the film is this incredibly loving, committed, bickering, funny family, and everybody's an original. You know, you mentioned Jill, the president of the bank. Yes, she's the impatient daughter, and is under a lot of pressure to keep the bank going in the midst of all of this.
Right.
There's Vera, the vice president, who's sort of emotionally undone in ways about it. Then there's Chanterelle, the youngest daughter, who was working in D.A. Vance's office as an assistant district attorney at the time that he was about to indict the family bank. And she, you know, on principle, she resigned and left to go and support her family.
And I feel like I should interrupt you when you say her name because she keeps getting interrupted by the other family members.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to finish my sentence.
Yeah. And then there's Mrs. Song, of course, who in many ways,
I love her.
Kind of steals the movie.
Yes.
Because she is both so honest and candid about the pain that this has exacted on them and the shame that they feel as a family, even though they feel so strongly in their innocence. And yet she has also got, sort of the comic timing of, the best stand-up comics when it comes to inserting a little funny comment here and there.
She must have been a dream for you as a filmmaker.
She was. I mean, at the beginning of this, when we started filming, we were told that Mrs. Song did not really want to participate. She was so upset about this whole thing, the last thing she wanted to do was being a film about it.
Right.
And it wasn't, I finally convinced her to just do an interview, like a single interview. And that went well, and after that she warmed up, and thank God the film is much richer for it.
And I'm not going to blow the ending, but at the end of everything, people say, well, how do you feel? And she has this quip, well, I'm not supposed to express my feelings. Like, I've been holding it in. She's been holding it in because she just really has so much to say that she can't say in the context of the trial.
Yeah.
I love how you managed to capture the family dynamics by really focusing on food.
Yeah.
And, just go follow a family out to dinner.
Yes.
Or when dad has a sandwich and does, thinks it's a bit dry. And then that's, that's every family. It's so universal.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And it's something that we heard time and again on the festival circuit. We heard it, and the Songs, of course, heard it tenfold, which is that people would come up afterwards, people of all nationalities, but it was particularly meaningful when Asian viewers and Chinese viewers in particular would come up and would say to them or to us, it's like, thank you for this portrayal of a real Chinese-American family, that they felt like they saw themselves in this family and that there are too few representations of these families, I think, in the media, including in documentary and certainly for sure in television and narrative film.
I want to talk for a moment about the bank having been in a little bit of trouble before and there being a run on a bank and how Tom Sung handled it. And then give us an idea of what that sort of brought to mind for listeners who...
Yes. Well, yes. And, Mr. Sung had kind of come to be known by a number of people in Chinatown. This was not our idea. As the sort of George Bailey of Chinatown, from It's a Wonderful Life. And that had to do with the fact that the bank was a central pillar in the community, that it was a community bank that was devoted to building the community, not just profiting or even profiting, really, from the community. So back in 2003, there was this incident where a bank employee embezzled some money and tried to abscond with it. Now, they were caught. But the media attention around it freaked out so many depositors of the bank that there was this run on the bank, and it was an extraordinary event. And it was Mr. Sung, much like George Bailey, Jimmy Stewart, in the movie, who basically went and calmed the residents and the depositors down and appealed to the bond and the trust that they had in him, and he basically single-handedly ended the run. And I think that then cemented his legacy as when you look at Thomas Sung in the movie, he's tall and lean. He's kind of an elderly version, I think, Chinese version anyway, of Jimmy Stewart.
Right. And he talks about just the importance of feel my warm hand. I'm a real person.
Yes.
One by one by one. I love that. How has this film sort of changed your perspective? What do you take away from it?
Well, I take a lot of things away from it. I mean, this was my first time really spent in any intimate degree with Chinese Americans. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that. I mean, I know different Chinese Americans in the course of my travels in life and in film, but to really spend the time intensively with this family and get to know them and come to understand them was a remarkably wonderful experience for me. And then, of course, this was such an underreported case. No one was really covering this story. I think we all felt honored to have the opportunity to bring this story to light, no matter how it turns out.
Right.
we felt this was an important story to tell. And because it has so much to say about you know, positive things to say about perseverance and determination, but also it is an indictment, I think, of our criminal justice system and the unequal application of justice in this country.
Right. And there is such a strong message at the end about legacy, and, you know, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but they really take this seriously, the cost on the family, financially, emotionally, physically, the cost is enormous, but they look at it as a way to, you know, build their own character and stand for their community, for something that's larger than themselves.
Yeah, and I think that a big motivator for them to even participate in this film was not just because, look at what's happening to us, you know, the Sungs and our bank, but look what's happening to our community, and this is a story that is about something bigger than us, and they felt that in their bones, and I think that was a big part of why they wanted to let us in to tell the story.
Frontline's Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, premieres tonight. You can see it on SDPB-TV at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. Don't miss it. Steve James, director of the documentary, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoy talking.